Hello, it's Wednesday the 28th of January. I'm John Dennis. Today, the Cabinet's decision to go to war with Iraq could be laid bare after the Information Tribunal rules that details of their crunched 2003 meetings should be made public.
Anyone who's expecting to find Tony Blair admitting, well, chaps, I know there are no WMD, but I'm just doing it anyway as a favour to George Bush, is going to be disappointed.
Also today, Barack Obama signals a new era in American relations with the Muslim world and engagement in the Middle East peace process.
I think the most important thing is for the United States to get engaged right away. And George Mitchell is somebody of enormous stature.
And after a human rights lawyer is slain by a gunman in a Moscow street, from the authorities, silence.
My personal suspicion is that the trail leads to Chechnya. He was dealing with a lot of sensitive Chechen cases, including representing the families of people who've been tortured in secret prisons.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Sandy Waugh with today's news headlines and the papers.
The new American envoy to the Middle East, George Mitchell, has arrived in the region on his first trip. He'll go to Egypt today, then Israel, the West Bank and Jordan. Egypt has led the peace negotiations between Israel and Hamas, who control Gaza. Mitchell is trying to promote a permanent ceasefire. We'll hear more shortly on Guardian Daily. Meanwhile, the Israelis have carried out more attacks along the Gaza Strip border with Egypt. Israeli aircraft fired missiles at tunnels used for smuggling both food and arms, which are said to have been reopened after the ceasefire. The outbreak of violence began again yesterday after a roadside bomb killed an Israeli soldier. In Britain, the counter-terrorism minister Lord West said that Israel's attack on Gaza has set back relations with British Muslims. Speaking to a seminar, he said it's made attempts to combat radicalisation of Muslims more difficult. He contradicted previous government claims by admitting that foreign policy clearly had an effect on terrorism. He said many in the Muslim community believed there was a link between Israel and the West. Sir Paul Stevenson has been appointed as Commissioner of London's Metropolitan Police. He's been deputy for 4 years, but became acting commissioner in December when Sir Ian Blair resigned. Sir Paul beat Sir Hugh Orde, Chief Constable of Northern Ireland, to the job. He was already in charge when he authorised the controversial arrest of Shadow Immigration Minister Damian Green over alleged Home Office leaks. The Brazilian and Manchester City football star Robinho has been arrested over allegations of sexual assault at a Leeds nightclub. His agent confirmed that he'd been questioned by police, but said he strenuously denied any allegations and was happy to cooperate with the police. Robinho was bought for more than £32 million from Real Madrid, a British record. That story's on the front page of The Sun this morning, saying that a teenage first-year university student is claiming that Robinho raped her. On the sports pages, City's rival Manchester United get star billing after they beat West Bromwich Albion 5-0. Much of that thanks to goalkeeper Van der Sar, who set a new record for how long he stopped any player scoring a goal against him. On the front pages, several pictures of the American writer John Updike, who's died of cancer. A literary giant, The Telegraph calls him. He was the poet of sex and suburbia, says The Independent. He took the novel onto another plane of intimacy, writes Martin Amis in The Guardian. Peter Mandelson, the business minister's plan to help the car industry, gets a showing in the Financial Times and The Times as he meets car industry leaders today. The FT also reports that the Spanish bank Santander will repay private investors whose money it invested with the alleged fraudster Bernard Madoff. The Guardian's late front page story is about the alleged corruption in the House of Lords. It reports that Labour and the Tories are both drawing up plans that would mean peers for hire would face expulsion from the Lords. It'll be announced today by Baroness Royal, the government leader in the Lords. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
In March 2003, Tony Blair's government decided to go to war with Iraq. The cabinet met twice to discuss the issue and whether an invasion was allowed under international law. Now the government has been ordered by the Information Tribunal to release the minutes of those cabinet meetings. Our senior political correspondent, Andy Sparrow, has the details.
We're not necessarily going to see them. Under the Freedom of Information legislation, the government has the power as a last resort to issue a veto and say, even if the courts tell us we've got to publish this, we can sign a bit of paper and exempt ourselves. They've never used that, and there would be a hell of a row if they tried to, but it's there in legislation. So they've got 28 days to decide whether or not they're going to either issue a veto, publish the minutes, or go to the High Court for sort of one more roll of the dice. If we do get them published, anyone who's expecting to find Tony Blair admitting, well, chaps, I know there are no WMD, but I'm just doing it anyway to, as a favour to George Bush, is going to be disappointed. There isn't any smoking gun in that, and we know that because there's a line in the tribunal judgment we got yesterday that more or less says that the arguments that were aired at this meeting were arguments that have been aired by cabinet ministers who took part before and since in public. But what we will get is a sense of how rigorously the legal arguments about the war was tested. What happened at the second of those cabinet meetings, the one on March the 17th, is they cabinet ministers arrived and they were handed a five-paragraph note from the Attorney General saying, this is why I think going to war is legal. And there's been a hell of a row ever since about whether or not sort of that legal advice was sound. There are plenty of people who believe that there was no legal justification for it. What we don't know is whether cabinet ministers really challenged that or whether they rolled over and said, okay, sort of that's fair enough.
Because the then Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, had made an earlier legal judgment just a couple of weeks earlier on which appeared to contradict his March the 17th judgment.
Yes, on March the 7th, he had written a considered legal opinion for the Prime Minister, and it was circulated within a very tight circle in Downing Street. And that was very, very measured about the legality of the war. He said, on balance, you could make a case for the invasion being legal, but he flagged up all sorts of caveats, and he said that was conditional on the UN saying that Iraq wasn't complying with UN. And at that stage, remember, Saddam had been going through a show of complying with the demands of weapons inspectors. So it was a very nuanced, sort of measured legal judgment. I mean, it didn't say it was illegal, and it said on balance you could make a case for it being legal, but it also said that it's a case that would be open to challenge in the courts. And it didn't flatly contradict what the cabinet were presented with 10 days later, but the tone of it was very different. The document they got 10 days later didn't have any of those caveats in. Lord Goldsmith subsequently said, well, that's because events changed in the meantime and there was no contradiction and I wasn't lent on by Downing Street and that was my considered opinion. But there are a lot of people who believe, well, actually, if that had been tested at the cabinet meeting, if people had said to him, well, oh, look, are you sure about this? What about legal precedent A, B and C? Then the cabinet would be far more reluctant to agree to the war than they were on the basis of this fairly sort of bland and one-sided five-paragraph, basically, is a press release rather than a legal opinion.
Andrew Sparrow, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, Marcel Berlin's on Wikipedia, which faces a revolt by thousands of contributors over plans to get a group of editors to vet changes to the site. Have your say on that at Comment is Free. And after a woman in Los Angeles gives birth to 8 babies, everything you wanted to know about octuplets at guardian.co.uk/health. And how to write the perfect pop song. Will Hodgkinson asks various people about that, including Phil Collins. guardian.co.uk/music. Barack Obama's Middle East envoy George Mitchell is making his first trip to the region. And Obama has given his first formal interview since becoming president to Al Arabiya, an Arabic television network based in Dubai. In it, he sought to mend America's ties with the Muslim world.
My job is to communicate the fact that the United States has a stake in the well-being of the Muslim world, that the language we use has to be language of respect. You know, I have Muslim members of my family. I have lived in Muslim countries. So what I want to communicate is the fact that in all my travels throughout the Muslim world, what I've come to understand is that regardless of your faith, and America is a country of Muslim, Jews, Christians, non-believers, regardless of your faith, people all have certain common hopes and common dreams.
Ewan McCaskill is in Washington.
There was absolutely nothing new in Obama's interview with Al Arabiya, but that's not the significance. The important thing was it was his first foreign interview, and he chose to give it to an Arab station. So, you know, that was a big gesture. You know, he didn't go for one of the big papers in Europe or, you know, maybe Canada or, you know, close neighbours like Latin America. He made his priority the Arab and Muslim world. I think he must hope that people in the region will recognise the gesture and the sort of courtesy of going there first.
He repeated his intention to make good his election pledge to visit a Muslim country's capital in the near future.
He did. He said he would visit a Muslim country within the first 100 days. I mean, there's been lots of speculation in the American media as to which country that might be. A lot of people think he might go to Indonesia because he lived there as a child, and you know, there would be some sort of resonance. Other people say it might be Cairo, so that way he would be engaging directly in the sort of Middle East peace process. But no one knows, and there's been no leaks from the Obama administration as to what capital he's going for.
And on the Middle East peace process, Ewan, the former Senator George Mitchell has begun his first trip to the region since being appointed Obama's envoy to the Middle East. What's his brief?
The important thing here is that Obama's signalling that he's going to be engaged in the Middle East peace process from day one. Clinton only became heavily involved, Bill Clinton only became heavily involved towards the end of his administration, and it was all too late. George Bush never really became engaged. They had the Annapolis conference 2007, but that was mainly for show. It was a sort of empty facade. Obama's saying, from day one, I'm serious about this, and he's appointing a Mitchell who's got tons of experience in peacemaking from Northern Ireland. He was involved in the Middle East before, so he's definitely got the background to do it. In Washington, there's a lot of scepticism about it. They say that the situation in the Middle East, the Israeli election, Benjamin Netanyahu is due to probably he's ahead in the polls and his hardliner. The Palestinians still recovering from the onslaught in Gaza. It's not an auspicious time for peacemakers, but Mitchell believes in perseverance, so he's in there. As far as he's concerned, as far as Obama's concerned, they're going to keep at it day after day for the next 4 years, if he manages to win the next election.
Obama has got his work cut out. I mean, he's had a cool response so far from Arab and Muslim leaders.
Any time when you engage in, say, the Israeli-Palestinian issue or Iran or Pakistan or Afghanistan, if you're going to start telling people tough things, which is what you have to do, then you're going to get a sort of cool reaction. It didn't help much on Friday when one of his first actions, you know, within just a few days of being in office, was to launch two missile strikes inside Pakistan. That's not necessarily the way to go around sort of winning friends. People in the Obama administration, people around Mitchell, say that you have to combine a sort of military toughness or economic sanctions, the hard end of policy. You have to combine that with diplomacy. Diplomacy itself is never going to work.
Ewan McCaskill. I'm John Dennis. Coming up on Guardian Daily, a crunch decision by the Arts Council whether to continue funding a high-tech arts centre in West Bromwich.
It's only recently been opened. Give it a chance.
You've spent so much money already. It's too late, really, to turn back. Better to go forward.
But first, voters would accept a steep rise in airfares to reduce the environmental damage caused by flying. That's according to the British Social Attitudes Survey, which canvassed the views of more than 4,000 people. The study was conducted by the National Centre for Social Research. With the details is our social affairs editor, John Carville.
Researchers had difficulty getting to the nub of this problem, because if you asked people, should people be free to fly around as much as they choose, basically most people would say yes to that, because they get in their heads a question about freedom and should the government step in and stop them. But then if you add the rider, should they be free to do it even though it does damage to the environment, people think, oh God, what am I meant to think, and they swing the other way. So the majority overwhelmingly goes to say no, people shouldn't have freedom to damage the environment. So what the researchers did was to try and get a question which was a bit more neutral, and to ask, well, would you be prepared yourself to pay significantly more to fly to reduce the impact of environmental damage? And it's that, the answer to that question, which has been changing quite sharply over the last 4 or 5 years. A few years ago, hardly anybody agreed with that. Now half the people agree and only a quarter disagree. So the balance is saying, OK, we're up for this.
And this should embolden and encourage our politicians to be brave in their policy making on the environment.
I think so. Both in Britain and in the EU, they have been talking about putting on airport taxes. They've been talking about changing the tax from the per person in the plane to per plane, so that empty planes aren't encouraged to fly around the place. There is a move to it, and I think there was a fear among the politicians that although they needed to do that to hit environmental targets, to reduce carbon emissions, that the people wouldn't let them get away with it. Well, this is actually suggesting, okay guys, the people will let you get away with it, get on with it.
Now, the British Social Attitude Survey did ask this sample of 4,000 people about a range of issues. What else did they find out?
Masses of stuff. I was interested in the increasing popularity of the NHS, which has really been recovering dramatically since 1997, but more particularly since the year 2000. It had a big reduction in popularity in the period going through the Thatcher and Major years. It's recovered back to where it was in 1984. Interestingly, GPs are still the most popular part of the service. People rate outpatients very highly now that they have to wait less long and get more choice. They're beginning to get a few more questions about the quality and safety of inpatients. And if the NHS, as it's gradually runs towards the end of the period of huge increase in spending, if it is to actually carry on getting the patient satisfaction, it needs to tackle that. And also dentists, they're the least popular bit of the NHS, because in some parts of the country, it's so hard to get one.
John Carville. Stanislav Markelov was one of Russia's most famous human rights lawyers and a close colleague of the murdered journalist Anna Politkovskaya. Last week, he was murdered, along with a freelance journalist. They were both gunned down in the street in Moscow. The Guardian's Moscow correspondent, Luke Harding, attended Markelov's funeral.
Stanislav Markelov was gunned down last week after giving a press conference. He was walking towards the metro in the centre of Moscow. I have to say, in a very upmarket district about 10 minutes away from the Kremlin and more or less right next to the main cathedral here, he'd gone about 200 metres when a gunman came up to him from behind using a sort of arm with a pistol and shot him twice in the back of the head. And then at this point, the young journalist who was with him, who was a trainee journalist with the Novaya Gazeta newspaper, the kind of main opposition newspaper here, according to her colleagues, she tried to grab the gunman. And he sort of paused rather calmly and shot her in the head and ran off and disappeared into the metro. The most depressing thing about this story is, as ever, when opponents of the Kremlin are killed, assassinated. There were basically no witnesses. There were no video cameras working, no police at the scene. The whole episode is depressingly reminiscent of the murder of Anna Politkovskaya, the campaigning journalist who was a very good friend of Stanislav Markelov's, who was herself gunned down in October 2006.
When Anna Politkovskaya was murdered, she was described by Vladimir Putin as an extremely insignificant figure, well known only in the West. How have the authorities responded to Markelov's death?
There's been really a kind of awful silence, I think is probably the only way of putting it. There's been no statement at all from either Vladimir Putin, the Prime Minister, or from Dmitry Medvedev, the President, who's given many speeches talking about the need to turn Russia into a law-based state. Now, what Markelov's friends say, and I went to his funeral last week, it was very dramatic. His coffin was brought in, and then in Russian fashion, the lid was taken off, and his relatives kissed him on the forehead and said goodbye, threw carnations into his coffin before he was buried in a sort of snowy plot. But what they say is that the Kremlin's silence on this, on this dreadful murder, really is a sort of sign of tacit approval to the whatever kind of dark and reactionary forces actually killed him.
Is there much public outrage at his murder?
Well, that's the thing. His death has been covered very glancingly by the state-controlled TV here. His funeral merited 15 seconds on the evening news. So a lot of people simply don't know about it. Those who are better informed, those who are kind of liberals, Democrats in Russia, generally small in number and basically in Moscow and St. Petersburg, they've been outraged. They've laid carnations at the site where he was gunned down. They've lit candles. And I think it's a very depressing moment. I think it's a very depressing moment for Russia that, firstly, someone of his stature, he was a very famous human rights defender here. He had represented the families of Chechens who had disappeared. He'd supported anti-fascist groups, pacifist groups, journalists who'd been beaten up, other people who'd been tortured by the authorities. That his death can go really kind of unnoticed. No one seems to care. We seem to have got to sort of such a, you know, Russia seems to become such a sort of brutalized society that really anybody can be killed. And the depressing thing for Novaya Gazeta, the paper that he worked very closely with, is that four of their journalists have now been murdered since 2000. And of course, the big question here is who's next?
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
2,500 delegates, including dozens of world leaders, are attending the World Economic Forum at the Swiss resort of Davos. But the usual glitz has been replaced by a more sombre tone, thanks to the global economic downturn. Julian Glover, The Guardian's chief leader writer, is in Davos.
Davos is one of those very strange things that nobody quite knows why it happens, but somehow it does. And up in the mountains where I am now, there's deep snow, really cold outside, icy, slippery pavements. And yet, despite all of that, huge numbers of world leaders and quite a lot of the remaining rich people in the world turn up and talk about economics and social justice and the environment and all sorts of different things. But of course, the big topic this year is just the collapse of the global economy. And I think they're expecting 40 heads of state or prime ministers to come this year. So there's going to be an awfully grand crowd of people. Whether they've got any ideas, I don't know.
Gordon Brown has placed great importance on world leaders coming together and having some kind of unified solution. Do you think what happens at Davos this week will go some way toward achieving Brown's hopes?
That's certainly what he'd probably like, and he's coming along. It's also what lots of the people who run Davos would like. They'd like this to be seen as the forum that rescued the world. Of course, a year ago, it wasn't the forum that predicted the problem, so one wonders how much they really are kind of plugged into what to do. The other issue, of course, is sort of how much the formal agenda matters and whether there's big sessions in public. Or maybe what will really be important here is the chance meetings in corridors, the little private dinners, things where just one person sees somebody else and says, I've got a good idea, what about doing this? And quite often that can have an effect. I think the big speeches and the set piece events probably won't be where Davos has decided.
40 world leaders, Julian, but no Barack Obama.
No, it's not surprising, really. He's only just become president, and his team are only just working out how to log onto their computers in the White House. So I doubt American voters would take it kindly if they all flew off to Switzerland. There are a couple of people from the top of the administration coming, and there's plenty of Americans. There's lots and lots of people from American business. But, of course, going through the guest list, you do notice the omissions from last year. We had Lehman Brothers was very prominent when I was here a year ago. They seem to have gone bankrupt in the interim, so they're not turning up. Quite a few of the big American names aren't coming because of the crisis. But there will be a lot of familiar people from Google, from Microsoft, Rupert Murdoch, Bill Gates, all sorts of names are coming. And maybe it will make a difference. One can only hope, of course.
Julian Glover. Nearly £60 million has been spent on The Public, what was hailed as a new high-tech kind of art centre in West Bromwich in the West Midlands. Designed by Will Allsop, its centrepiece is an interactive gallery. But The Public has been delayed by financial problems, and yesterday the Arts Council met to decide whether to cut off Public's supply of cash, Martin Wainwright reports.
I've come to West Bromwich in the Black Country in the Midlands, a place I don't know very well. It's to some extent what you'd expect. It's got a fairly bog-standard shopping centre and a very ordinary-looking bus station, but it's also got something extraordinary, and that's the public, a £63 million lottery project here. The Arts Council is debating. We've given a lot of money to this project. Huge lottery grant, revenue costs since. Do we now pull the plug? I'm with David Clark, who's the project director here. And first thing I've got to say is I hadn't realised, I mean, the image impression has slightly been given that this is kind of, you know, not being used, and that's very far from the case.
We just wanted to get the building open and let people see it for themselves. It's really difficult to describe in words, I think.
It certainly is.
and that's been great. You know, we've got all the usual kind of great art centre stuff going on, music three or four nights a week, theatre, dance, exhibitions around the building. Places take time, don't they? And there's no escaping the fact that the place has had a checkered history. When I came to it in 2006, things look pretty bleak in lots of ways. But I think it has to work for Sandwell. There is nowhere else. There is no other arts infrastructure. There isn't really a community building that people can come and do those kinds of International Women's Day and all of those kinds of celebratory events.
Is the eye of this particular storm the gallery? I mean, can you? I think a lot of people have difficulty taking the gallery on board. Quite understand? Can you explain the gallery?
Yes, it's so frustrating that it's not open for you to see. And part of the reason for that is it's technically incredibly complicated and state of the art. So it's something that West Brom hasn't had before in that way, and it hasn't been done before in this country, actually. Basically, when you go to the gallery, you create an identity for yourself on the sort of underlying system. And you take a little tag round with you, which means that the gallery recognises you as you go around, knows it's you. So every time we come up to an exhibit, it knows it's you, and it knows your favourite colours and the art you've made as you go around. And you make things interacting with the gallery.
And you think it can make it? It's not a step too far. I mean, you reckon it can be sorted out?
No, I think it can. We're quite close to the end. We're in what's called integration, my colleagues on the IT team assure me, which is the last bit where everything else is working, and then you have to put it all together end to end, and that always throws up a few bugs at the interfaces between different things, and that's what they're doing now. But we are very close.
Have you got a sort of final word to the Arts Council, final appeal to the Arts Council?
Big new projects like this are never easy, and I think, you know, we owe it to the people of Sandwell, who don't have any other cultural infrastructure and are learning to use the building and enjoying the building. I think the Arts Council needs to stand alongside us, and we all need to hold our nerve and keep serving the people of Sandwell, really.
Martin Wainwright. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.